Okay, we are back in session. We are in section three, number two. This is a time and place scheduled for the informal interview of Catherine Burns, DVM, in case number 21-158. This matter will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given it in ARS 3222-34. Dr. Burns, please introduce yourself and your attorney if represented by counsel.
This is Dr. Catherine Burns.
And David Stoll, appearing as legal counsel for Dr. Burns.
Thank you. Dr. Burns, you've received a letter informing you of the matters to be discussed today and the possible actions the board may take at this informal interview. As a reminder, those options include dismissal, issuing you a non-disciplinary letter of concern, censuring you, and placing your license on probation with terms that may include continuing education and practice restrictions. The board may also suspend your license for up to 30 days, assess a civil penalty, or refer this matter to a formal hearing. The purpose of this informal interview is to inquire into the facts and circumstances of this case. The board has read all the materials you submitted. If you have any additional materials you would like to present to the board, please do so now.
We have no additional materials.
Thank you. This proceeding is being digitally recorded. As a result, it is important that everyone speak loudly and clearly, and that only one person speaks at a time. We will begin by asking the lead board member assigned this matter to give a brief summary of the case, and then you'll be given an opportunity to respond. Following your response, the board may wish to ask you some questions. If present, the complainant will also be given an opportunity to address the board. If you have any questions for the board or anyone giving information during this interview, you may ask them through me. Dr. James, would you please give us a brief summary of the case?
Case 21-158. On June 4th, 2021, Olive, a six-year-old female miniature dachshund, was presented to Dr. Burns after being bitten by a rattlesnake. The dog was hospitalized for treatment and monitoring. No antivenom was administered due to Dr. Burns' evaluation of the dog. Later that evening, the dog was sent home with instructions to go to an emergency facility if the dog became worse. The dog passed away in the early morning hours.
Dr. Burns, at this time, I'd like to swear you in. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Dr. Burns, we'd now like to give you the opportunity to respond to the summary and present whatever information you believe is relevant.
Thank you. I have a statement I'd like to read.
Please proceed.
I thought this would be better on my phone. Is this better? No?
Yes, that's fine. Go ahead and read your statement now. We're all going to be very quiet.
Okay. While I was initially pleased that the investigative committee recommended that this complaint be dismissed with no violation, I understand that you moved the case to this informal interview because you have questions as to why I included antivenom in my treatment plan, but ultimately elected not to give it. Before answering any questions you may have, I want to explain why the antivenom was not given and why, even if I had, the outcome in this case might well have been the same. First of all, antivenom is not a quick fix that is immediately given as a cure-all in every snake bite. It should be given judiciously and only when, in the veterinarian's mind, it is medically appropriate. It was included in the treatment plan for potential administration, depending on how Olive did while under my observation. Here is a summary of how Olive did while under my observation. At initial presentation, Olive had mild swelling of her masseter muscles associated with strike wounds over the occipital portion of her skull. Swelling was significantly less than what I might have expected relative to other envenomations or bites that I have treated. It was my opinion that the amount of venom associated with the bite was minimal, as if she was running away from the snake when it struck, thus receiving wounds on the back of her head. During the 8-hour time span that Olive was in my care, she was monitored and assessed regularly. The swelling I observed at the time of initial presentation did not progress or worsen at all. Some of the dwellings that I observed did translocate eventually, but it didn't worsen. I've seen this phenomenon many times with other cases of hypersensitivity reactions, such as bee stings and vaccine reactions, and this translocation was not deemed as a cause for concern as it typically resolves. When I discharged Olive to her owner at the end of the day, there was also no sign of worsening swelling to her head, face, or body. Olive's temperature, pulse, respiration, mucous membrane color, and capillary refill time all remained within normal limits during her entire hospitalization. Finally, I had repeated a CBC 5 to 6 hours after the initial CBC, and it didn't reveal any hemolysis or breakdown of red blood cells. Therefore, I did not give antivenin because I had repeatedly assessed Olive as stable, and her physiological and hematological parameters did not suggest worsening of her condition, which would have justified giving the antivenin. Had Olive's vitals not remained constant, and if her swelling had gotten worse or her condition deteriorated, I would have given the antivenin that had been authorized. However, even then, antivenin is not a cure-all in every case, and there is no guarantee that Olive's outcome would have been any different than it was. As pointed out by the investigative committee in their report, this was a judgment call on my part whether to give the antivenin, and because Olive remained stable, it was not given. The committee concluded that my decision was justified based on my assessment, the blood panels that I performed, and given the fact that I had followed recommendations on the Veterinary Information Network. In retrospect, I do stand by that decision, and I'm now available to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. And I'd like to ask the board members if they have any questions for Dr. Burns.
This is Dr. James, and I have a couple questions. So, at discharge, I mean, I hear you on why you chose not to give the antivenom, but at the time of discharge, did you recommend this dog go to a 24-hour hospital?
I did not recommend that the dog be transferred directly to a 24-hour hospital. I sent the dog home with an IV catheter in place with copies of her records and some conversation about signs that the owner could look for so that she was prepared if she had to go to a 24-hour hospital.
So in your experience with rattlesnake bites, do you think that the monitoring you did during the day got this dog through the critical period and that you didn't have concern that this was going to continue to worsen overnight?
Yes, actually, I do think after, you know, based again on my own experiences, there have actually been not very many patients that I have referred to an emergency clinic directly from the hospital. So I was not expecting for her to dramatically deteriorate. Otherwise, certainly if I had felt that way, I absolutely would have either had her directly transferred or certainly strongly encouraged direct transfer to the emergency facility.
Okay. And in your decision on whether to give the antivenom or not, did you discuss that with the owner as far as, because, you know, obviously they got it as an estimate and it was a potential.
Right.
Did you discuss with them why you may or may not give it?
At this stage, I honestly cannot tell you that I remember clearly. I mean, that was June of 2021, so if I said that or not, I think my intention was to communicate that I was going to do dexamethasone, dexamethasone fluid support monitoring. The treatment plan was meant to reflect that, and so then on the treatment plan or estimate, you know, I think that it was included at the high end of the estimate in the event that I felt like antivenin was necessary. But again, I was working on an assessment and an opinion that her stripe was and the amount of incentive that she had received was minor based on how she presented initially. So my intention was to continue to reassess her, as I did through the day, to see if antivenom was going to be indicated.
Yeah, and I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out, would the pet owner have been brought along during the course of the day and your decision making on why or why not to give it? Or do you feel like maybe part of this is they were kind of left out of that, and so then in hindsight they're looking back going, well, why didn't she give it? Like, because they weren't really kind of explained kind of the pros and cons of it, I guess is what I'm saying.
All I can do is be honest and tell you that I cannot recall at this stage how much of a communication like that may have happened.
Okay, totally understandable.
Mr. Chair,
during the day you did the two CBCs and the platelets had declined during that time, but everything else had stayed stable. Did you have any thoughts on why that would happen?
Well, I just felt like that, might not be an unreasonable thing, to happen in the idea that there is, a bite, there's wounds, the body was responding to those things. Also with in-house laboratory work, sometimes those things are not always, as exact as you might like them to be. So I felt like the decrease was minor, that the platelets were still within normal range. There certainly wasn't any indication that we were, experiencing hemolysis, like we talked about with her hematocrit was still the same. So I did not believe the lower platelet count to be clinically significant.
Okay. And the emergency facility that you typically refer to, is it your closest one? And how far away is that?
It is the closest one. It is, so that's the Yavapai Emergency Animal Hospital in Prescott Valley. And Prescott Valley is a good hour's drive. So there's another emergency facility in Flagstaff, but I believe they are only open, they're open next weekend, holidays, but they're at the same as equidistant, or maybe Flagstaff a little further.
Okay. So in the event that this pet did decline overnight, do you think they would have gotten them there in time?
That's really kind of speculation, and I'm not sure that it's a fair question or answer. And I did notice in some of the comments, made by others that Olive seemed fine, that there wasn't any of the signs that I had recommended that she looked for. So, and then at 1 a.m. she's away. So I'm not really sure I can answer that question fairly.
I don't have any additional
questions. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have two quick questions. Dr. Burns, this is Jane Solomon. I'm a public member of the board. I have two quick questions. Approximately how many snake bite cases have you handled?
I've handled probably about 12 in the 7 years that I've been in Arizona.
Okay, okay. And of those, how many times have you administered antivenom or recommended the administration of antivenom?
Actually administered it probably about half of a dozen and recommended it. There's at least one case that I can remember recommending it and the owners were financially unable to pursue antivenom therapy. So there's been a number of cases then that I have not administered antivenom based on the lack of severity of clinical signs.
Okay. I have three, a quick follow-up question. Can you tell me, as a, since I'm a layperson, what are the key indicators you made your decisions on in those cases?
That I administered antivenom?
Or didn't? When you chose to or chose not?
Yes. So probably all of the same indicators or that I, an assessment parameters that I used with all of, which would be apparent severity of the snake bite, so how much swelling that they had, the location of the snake bite, whether it was in the mouth or on the body or on the face, certainly their physiological parameters, you know, at the time of presentation, sometimes blood work. So again, all of the same parameters that I went through to assess if Olive required antivenom administration, I went through with each one of those cases.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Just one question, and this is Dr. Nosley. Really, it's more of a clarification. Did you say that when you were assessing the swelling, that you thought it might be an allergic reaction? Did I hear you right?
No, I didn't say that. I said that I have seen translocation of angioedema in true like allergic hypersensitivity reactions, like bee stings or vaccine reactions, and then sometimes that angioedema resolves at the site or in it, but it translocates eventually. You know, to like submandibular space. So I was, and you know, part of our treatment for snake infestations is diphenhydramine. So I was thinking along the lines of, well, she's got this, you know, swelling, which is not a surprise that she would, you know, have a little swelling from being struck by a snake and having some venom. How much venom? But again, the swelling just really was very minor, and so when I saw a little bit of translocation, it wasn't getting worse. Her head was not swelling worse, it was just translocating, and I thought, well, that is typical when I see it, you know, swelling, that sometimes it migrates centrally in response to gravity.
Okay, and when you see, let's take the case of a bee sting, do you see it, the swelling translocate like that?
Sometimes, if it's significant enough, yes.
Okay. I don't have any other questions.
Do any other board members have questions? Dr. Burns?
Yes.
Seeing none, we will move on now and we will hear from the complainant. And we have the complainant on the phone. Would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Karen Malmody.
Thank you. I'm going to swear you in now. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I sure, yes I do.
Thank you. And you are the complainant in this case, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. We have read all the materials you have provided, and you may address the board.
Okay. I have one quick question. Have you seen the pictures I provided?
Everything.
Okay. All right. I am here again, watching answers as to why my six-year-old dachshund Olive died from a snake bite. I realized she was critical. But why didn't Dr. Burns at least try the antivenom? Why did Dr. Burns and Dr. Flannery decide she didn't need it? Why didn't they at least try when I gave them permission, first thing when we arrived at Erica Animal Hospital? Why didn't they tell me to take her to the emergency vet first thing? All of them there within 30 minutes of the bite at 9 o'clock. The bite was on the top of her head. It was a big bite, which meant a big snake and more venom. I told them it was a big snake. I was there. I walked by it first and leave. I heard the loud and saw it coil up. I tried to grab Olive, but she was protecting me. I was able to grab Charlotte, her sister. I feel I let Olive down. She was very close to me. Why did they take her? They keep her all day, 7+ hours, and not tell me to take her to the emergency bed when it is important to give the antidote in the first 3 or 4 hours of the night. I called several times during the day. Taylor, the receptionist, kept telling me, that she was stable but sad. What does that mean? Taylor told me at about 3 to pick her up at 4:20, but Dr. Burns wanted to talk to me. I was concerned when I saw Olive. She was swollen a lot. Dr. Burns said this was normal. Swollen and looking miserable, she told me to give her 100 milligrams of gabapentin as soon as we got home. Or Taylor might have told me that. Isn't that a lot for a big doctor? Dr. Burns also said she hadn't urinated all day after all the IVs. That was another question. This is all of the witness information. Suzanne Bluff was there the whole time. If you have any questions, you have her phone number too. Dr. Burns said to watch for vomiting, diarrhea, and shortness of breath. None of this happened. She said if this happened, to take her to the emergency bed. This is 8+ hours after the bite. It would have been too late. After this, I called many of us in Cottonwood, Prescott, Phoenix, and all said they would have given me any of them. From PestMed, MD, dated 2/12/21, an article titled, "Can a dog survive a rattlesnake bite without antivenom?" It says, without treatment, your dog will suffer miserably, and smaller dogs may succumb to the effects of the toxins in the venom. The cornerstone treatment is intravenous fluids, pain meds, and antivenom. Most dogs are bitten on the head. That's where mine was bitten. About 80% of dogs can survive a snake bite if it's treated right away. If left untreated, dogs are less likely to recover. Where was Dr. Burns when I took my dead dog to Air Park Animal Hospital on Saturday, first thing in the morning? They let my sister Suzanne Bluff and myself wait in a room for 30 minutes with Olive, dead, before seeing Dr. Flannery. You have pictures, you have an audio. When I asked why didn't they send us to the emergency vet clinic that morning so Olive would have had a chance, the answer from Dr. Flannery was, woulda, coulda, shoulda. That's it.
Thank you. Do any board members have questions for the complainant?
This is Dr. James, and I have a couple questions. Do you feel like during the course of this and going through this, I'm assuming this is the first time you've had a dog that had a snake bite, but did you feel like you understood why the anti-venom may have been given or may not have been given?
No, they never told me that. That's why I signed the thing right away. I didn't even hesitate. I signed it, and I figured that that's what they were going to do.
Okay. And in your response, I mean, I see the pictures and the evidence of the swelling, but did you feel the swelling was the same at drop-off as it was at pickup?
I'm sorry, what was that? I didn't hear that.
The swelling, did you feel like it was the same at drop-off and when you dropped off for monitoring as when you picked up?
Oh, no. And if you want a witness, you can call the other number. No, she was, I was told by Taylor that Dr. Burns wanted to talk to me because she wanted to talk to me about how she looked when I came in there. I couldn't just come in there and pick her up after all day. They wanted to talk to me first about it. And she did not look good. But I watched very carefully for all the symptoms that they told me to watch for.
When you were watching, did you see anything else during the time that you were monitoring that may not have been on their list of things to watch for? I mean,
No, I don't. I knew at one point I took her out in the yard and put her down, but she couldn't stand up. And, you know, because I was thinking, because they said she had urinated, maybe she needed to urinate, but she couldn't stand up. And I was thinking maybe it was a gas pen lady, because they said to give it to her 100 milligrams as soon as we got home. And I thought maybe that just kind of knocked her out. But she was just sleeping. That's what I was thinking. They told me she was stable all day every time I called. And I called several times. And as far as I know, they only did blood work two times. When I first took her in, and then around two or three.
I don't have any additional questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Do any other board members have questions for the complainant? All right, so we'll move on from that. Thank you for your time and statement today. Dr. Burns, do you or your legal counsel have any additional remarks or questions you'd like to ask?
This is David Stoll. I have some concluding comments. I wish Dr. Wright were here because, as he pointed out during your review of the investigative committee's dismissal recommendation, he said, and I quote, "Antivenom is not an immediate cure-all. It's not without its own complications, and it's not something that you jump into." We believe that if you evaluate this case thoroughly, you will conclude that Dr. Burns handled this case appropriately. She got authorization to use antivenom in the event it should become medically necessary. And in her opinion, it never did become necessary because the dog's condition did not deteriorate in such a way that it was medically appropriate for her to give the antivenom. I think you all agree that the dog was closely monitored and observed all day long, and her vitals remained constant. There were two blood draws, and there is no notation of any additional swelling noted throughout that day. Ultimately, it's a judgment call for the doctor to make, and if you look at how Dr. Burns approached this case, I think you will conclude that her decision to not give the antivenom was well thought out. And again, justified given the lack of any deterioration or change, significant change in the dog's condition. Also, there is no guarantee that the outcome would have been any different, even if the antivenom had been given. In that regard, if she had given the antivenom, which again is not without side effects, and if the dog had not survived, and then you'd be second-guessing her decision to give the antivenom. So again, it's a judgment call that has to be made under all circumstances. Hindsight's 20/20, as we all know. We just simply ask that you judge Dr. Burns' decision not to give the antivenom based upon the information that she had at the time, not base your decision upon speculation that the outcome might have been different had she given the antivenom. Dr. Burns, do you have any additional comments?
No, I do not. I stand by the decision that I made with the information that I had at the time.
One other thing I meant to comment on is that the other thing that I think was complimentary to Dr. Burns is the way that she discharged the dog. She determined that the dog was stable and did not expect it to go to the ER, but in the event that it did need to go to the ER, she gave the owner a second copy of the medical records and kept the catheter in place. So she did everything that she could do in the event the dog's condition deteriorated. So, again, that supports our position that she handled the case appropriately from a medical standpoint. Thank you.
Are there any more questions from board members? All right, so this concludes a portion of the informal interview in which the board hears testimony. The board will now deliberate and decide what to do in this matter. And Dr. James, you will lead.
So I think initially from remembering back when we originally saw the case, the thought in my mind was around how much of the decision making was communicated with the owner. And I feel like even now, I don't fault the doctor for the decision that she made on the antivenom. I think it is one of those things that you can choose to use it and have a side effect that can be life-threatening, and you're going to say, I wish I hadn't. And then you're not going to use it, and you're going to say, well, if I had used it, would it have saved the dog? And none of us have a crystal ball. So I don't necessarily know that that's the problem I have with it. I think the problem I have with it is the fact that the pros and cons of using it weren't related to the owner, and so the owner couldn't be involved in the decision making and ultimately the outcome of what happened. I think the other piece that's interesting is knowing that you're as far away from an emergency clinic as you are, that the owner wasn't given the option of transferring from the day practice when you have a dog that's still significantly swollen, not moving around, not doing normal behaviors. You still have this, and whether that was needed or not, you wouldn't ever know, but if they had been given the option of going to the emergency clinic and the emergency clinic had continued to monitor, could things have been caught sooner? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know that it would have changed the outcome. But I feel like those are decisions that the owner should have been brought into so that they could have helped determine the outcome of what they wanted to do. And so that in the event that something like this does happen, which is horrible, the owner feels like they knew what was going on, right? Like there's some level of closure and we did the best we could, but I feel like in this case, she didn't know. And she feels like she let her dog down. But I think there's some guilt there. So I think those are my biggest concerns in this case. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Sorry. Go ahead, is that Nikki?
Yeah, sorry. I'm a little bit interested just because I get to see a lot of snake bites, and you know, typically, and any of the doctors can correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a 24 to 48 hour period that we're really intensely watching these patients. We're checking for echinocytes, which will indicate if we're giving any venin. In the early hours, obviously, it's most critical to do any venin, which you know it can be cost prohibitive. And I guess I haven't seen, at least in practice that I'm in, I haven't seen the fear of giving any venin or avoiding it. Just what I've seen in continuing education and CE from criticalists and toxicologists is diphenhydramine is contraindicated if they're for some reason having an allergic or anaphylactic reaction, you're giving epi. So I'm just curious about kind of the process of this, and I agree that the client should have been in on the adventure, you know, like what decisions were made and why, because it is really confusing from a client perspective. As you know, I don't know, you just need to see snake bites, right? And this is a really big deal. And so was there this question on was it a rattlesnake or not, you know, and that was the back and forth. But I mean, there's just so much with that tissue damage and, you know, monitoring, you know, for necrosis and, you know, there's just a lot that goes along with it. So I'm just curious about, from the doctor's perspective, again, from what I see in practice, it just looks a lot different. And so that's why I understand, like, for me, I'm even confused, you know, with it.
It was a rattlesnake, I saw it. Diamondback. That big one.
Okay, so this is the portion where just the board is discussing right now. Thank you.
Mr.
Go ahead.
I have a quick question for the veterinarians on the board. With the fact that it was a miniature dachshund weighing 15 pounds, had any effect on anti-venom, yes or no?
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes. Weight is a factor.
And would that have been, make it more likely that you would give an anti-venom to a smaller dog or a man?
Sure. If everything else being equal, you would definitely take that into consideration. Sure.
Thank you.
And then I had just a couple of comments. Based on my experience with snake bites over a long time, I evolved from being more, I'm going to avoid anti-venom, to I'm going to give anti-venom. Now, in hindsight, and knowing everything we know now, of course, I'm going to say, yeah, you should have given it. But again, that's hindsight. And I do believe that the doctor did a good job here, and I commend the second CPC. But there's something else that hasn't been brought up, but I think maybe Nikki mentioned it. Sometimes these patients get a horrendous necrosis at the site of the bite, and that can be greatly mitigated by early administration of the antidote. I can recall a case of a dog who was bit under the neck and did not really suffer much systemically, but a week later, he had a horrendous slough to the point where the dog's neck contracted down to his chest because of the scar tissue, and the whole chest necrosed. And thinking back on that case and doing some research, I found that giving antivenom early can prevent that too, and that hasn't been discussed here. So I lean toward giving it. Swelling, maybe decreasing platelets, and the situation of where this dog was going to be in reference to an emergency clinic, like Dr. Jane brought up. It seems to me that, and an owner that was ready and willing to pay for it. I commend the doctor for her attention to detail and her workup. Then on the other hand, I'm struggling with the fact that putting this all together, I would have given the antivenom early in this case, is how I feel about it after that.
So I've got a question, because I have been around the companion animal part of it for a while, and the food animals don't use the antivenom. But years ago, when I worked for a company who manufactured it, it was quite frequently on back orders. How many different companies make antivenom?
I think there's two or three, and they fall in and out. Sometimes they have it and they're making it, and sometimes they don't. That has to do with the process.
Okay, so part of it, I don't know the circumstances of what was happening with the company I was working at the time. That wasn't a primary product, but I did do some pet stuff in the rural areas. So is the decision making, do I use antivenom, is part of that due to the historical availability? Sometimes you don't have it, so you got to figure out what else to do?
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of that, how that process came about?
But I don't think it was in this case.
Yeah, it wasn't.
No, well, I'm just saying that there's a thought process, right? I mean, you learn things a certain way, you get out and practice, and you learn to maybe do it a little different way, and you know, over the years, I mean, each one of us adapts to what you work with, what you got, right?
Sure.
So, I don't think it affects the outcome of this, but I just wonder if it affects the outcome of, or if it affects the thought process, if that's part of their, well, whether they know it or not. If they're newer to that, they may not even know that that's how this idea evolved, or if that's what it was.
I think, like to Dr. Leslie's point, like it was, you could have a snake bite that would be just fine without the antivenom. I've had plenty. I work in a shelter. We don't have antivenom available. But when I'm in private practice and I have a client who's willing to pay for that antivenom, like that is the best course of treatment for that pet. Like maybe that pet would be okay without it, but why take that risk? And two, like it does reduce the swelling, it does reduce the pain. Like there's other pieces to it besides just life-saving. So I think, you know, knowing that the owner had already signed to do it, like that would be my dream client right there, as opposed to me not being able to provide that for my patient.
And I think the reason that, in my mind, the veterinarian to consider whether to do it or not is there, you can have reactions to it. So just like any drug, You could have a reaction to the anaphylaxis.
Like a general anaphylaxis or something like that?
I've never had a reaction.
It has to do with the fact that I believe it's passed through horses, horse serum, and that so it would be an allergic reaction to component.
It's an anaphylaxis.
It's a similar reaction,
my understanding, to other blood products.
Yeah, so you can't have a reaction to it. So if you don't, if you have a case where you're like, it's clear I don't need it, then don't get it.
So that brings up another point on availability and how it maybe changes people's habits. How easy is it to get epinephrine and have that in the fridge?
Say that again.
Epinephrine. How widely available is that? In the last few years, you couldn't get it.
You always have it in your crash first.
You know, if you're worried about an anaphylactic reaction, if you got a bottle of epinephrine in the fridge, so what? You watch it for 5 minutes, you see what's happening, you give a shot of the epinephrine, it's done.
I still go back to, you can take any case that you see. Let's take Dr. Nosley's example of the dog that had the big contracture, right? In hindsight, you're like, huh, I wish I had known that the anti-venom might have helped with that, I would have given it, right? You could think that. In a lot of cases we see, I think Dr. Thompson says she would have given the anti-venom, I think Dr. Nosley said he would have. Is it wrong for her to have assessed this case and say, I'm not going to give it?
That's the question,
because if we believe that she was completely 100% wrong, then I think you're dealing with some kind of malpractice. I personally think that there's some gray in this, and I can't 100% say that she's completely wrong, but I feel like the bigger issues are, you live in an area that you didn't have immediate access to an emergency veterinarian. The dog should have probably, in my mind, been referred early so that it could have stayed there longer, because while this doctor says that in 8 hours she typically sees the reaction, the cases I've seen haven't been in 8 hours from a bite. So I have seen them up to a day later that we started having complications. So that's where I was like, well, okay, I get we told the owner to monitor, but what if something happens in the middle of the night and you're now an hour plus away? Plus, that's pretty hard on an owner to stay up all night watching their dog and trying to judge whether that's an issue. I feel like the best course of action would have been for this dog to go to an emergency clinic and let them decide. And if the owner couldn't afford it, that's different, but that's not what happened here. And that was my bigger issue.
Yeah, I agree totally. And I think I said that when we talked about it before. I would have said, you need to go to the emergency clinic tonight. Not go if a dog does this or this, and I don't really understand the vomiting, diarrhea, but I think I would have been adamant about this dog going to the emergency clinic. And if they don't, then that's on them. Because like you said, now we're putting that onus completely on that owner to make a decision somewhere late in the night when this is now happening. And she said it could have been the gabapentin that made her so weak. The doctor didn't seem to be concerned about the swelling. Is she swelling more? And now we're putting all of this right on the owner's shoulders. Where this, if we would have just got in the car, drove to the emergency clinic, that's really where it should go. So I agree completely.
So I guess, and we don't have, you know, statistics in front of us, but part of the information that was presented to us is, in this veterinarian's case, treating a dozen snake bites, you're 50-50, 50% of them got the antivenom, 50% of them didn't, and she lost one of each. One that got the antivenom, one that didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. But all this complainant knows about is 100%, right? Because right. She just knows about the one.
Right.
So, you know, there's...
Well, if you have an owner, you go out and research it, the gold standard is antivenom. So this owner is looking online going, what do you do if your dog gets bit by a rattlesnake
and
it's antivenom?
And gold standard is not statute.
Right.
Statute is standard minimum. Yeah, today it was.
But I'm just saying, in this order's mind, that's what should have happened because of what you read and what's, and she had said yes to it, so I think that's playing it a little bit.
And when we first looked at this, I thought, well, why wouldn't she get Dana again? Before I listened to everything and read everything, I mean, that was the first thing, as a layperson, that's what crossed my mind. Well, why wouldn't she just get it?
So, I think for me, because I think there are different opinions, and I'm not 100% sure she was completely wrong, and I'm not sure it would have changed the outcome, that I'm leaning away from kind of a malpractice kind of thing, but more along the lines of a motion on 3222-3212 as it relates to our 311-5011 for professionally acceptable procedures on ensuring that this owner understood the pros and cons of giving or not giving the antivenom and referring this dog to an emergency facility for continued monitoring.
So, Dr. James, there's actually a rule for not referring.
But can I combine them in the same? Because they're not both. Or do I have to do two separate violations?
I think Mark needs to answer that question.
No, I think it can cover both of the concerns you express into a single violation.
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor and a second. Any further debate? Seeing none, let's do a roll call.
Ms. Crager?
Aye.
Ms. Frost?
Aye.
Dr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Lohi?
Aye.
Dr. Nosley?
Aye.
Ms. Solomon?
Aye.
Dr. Thompson?
Aye.
So the board has voted to find a violation. At next month's meeting, the board will consider adopting proposed findings of facts and conclusions of law. And after doing so, we'll then discuss and adopt disciplinary action. If you have any questions, please call the board's executive director, Victoria Whitmore, at the board's office. This concludes the informal interview. Thank you, everybody, for participating today here and on the phone.